This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
A new year and a lovely sky to start off with. I often think the evening sky in January is one of the best we can possibly see. We have that lovely constellation Orion the Hunter due south in the evening. The three stars of his belt point downwards to the left to the bright star Sirius in Canis Major. Up to the right, we come up to the constellation of Taurus the Bull and the little group of stars called the Hyades, which has an interloper, really, Aldebaran, a bright orangey star. It's a red giant star that forms the eye of Taurus the Bull. You carry on beyond that, you come to a rather lovely grouping of stars called the Pleiades. A lady called Carol has just bought a new telescope and she emailed the Jodcast as to what perhaps she might use it to look at. Well, the Pleiades is one obvious, beautiful thing to see with a small telescope, one of my favourite sights in the whole of the sky. There are two bright stars sort of in the centre of the Pleiades. One of them has got a lovely triplet of fainter stars beside it, and between it and the other there's a very nice double star, apparently, one of which is nice and red. A lovely area to look at. And that's one thing she should look at. Also, of course, start with the central star of Orion's belt, drop downwards, and you come to the Sword of Orion, a lovely region of nebulosity there, which is the Orion Nebula, which is a region of star formation. And at its heart, there's a lovely little group of stars called the Trapezium. We normally see four, but occasionally you can see a fifth. They're very, very bright blue stars. Their light, visual light, lightens up the whole of that region, showing the outlines of the dust clouds. But their ultraviolet light excites the hydrogen to give out this lovely pinky-red colour, the light from the hydrogen alpha line. So that's two lovely things to look at. I think the third thing I would say to look at, obviously now, is Jupiter, and we'll come back to that a little bit later on. Just continuing with the stars briefly, up to the left of Orion, we have Gemini, the heavenly twins, with Castor above and Pollux slightly below. And then down below them, what looks like just a single star, pretty much by itself, is Procyon, which is the bright star in Canis Minor. So that's a lovely region to look at. Above Orion, we have Auriga coming up towards the zenith with its bright yellowish star called Capella. The Milky Way actually runs between Orion and Gemini, above Taurus, through Auriga, and there's some very nice little star clusters, M36, 37, and 38, which you can pick out just about with binoculars, nice to observe with a telescope. As the evening goes on, then Leo the Lion will be rising in the southeast. And that's another nice constellation, looking like one of the lions in Trafalgar Square, sort of on its paws. So a lovely region to look at, and you can spend a long time just enjoying the sky at this time of year. Well, what about the planets? Well, I've already mentioned Jupiter, and it's beautifully seen now in the evening sky. On the 1st of January, at about 7:30 in the evening, it'll be high, about 50 degrees elevation, due south, so hardly a better time to observe it. It's on the boundary of Pisces and Aries. It's moving further away from us now. Basically, it's staying in the same place, but the Earth is moving away as it moves around the Sun. So the angular size has dropped a little to 41 arc seconds, but that still allows you to easily see the equatorial bands, two dark bands that go around the surface. In the lower of those, you may have a chance to see what's called the Great Red Spot, but it doesn't look particularly red to me. It looks like a rather faint yellow spot. In the highlights of the night sky page that I write each month, I have a list of the times when the Great Red Spot is actually in transit, basically facing us, and that should give you a good chance to have a look for it. I have noticed recently in the northern equatorial belt some quite prominent dark markings, and these are called barges. And as I said, if you haven't bought a small telescope yet, this is a lovely time to buy one. You've got Jupiter looking very lovely high in the sky, and as the months go on, Saturn will be more obvious, as we shall see. It passed behind the Sun on the 18th of October, some time ago now, and once they've done that, the planets always appear in the pre-dawn sky. So it rises, in fact, now, around the 1st of January, at 2 o'clock in the morning. Obviously, a bit too low to look at then. But that means by about 5 o'clock, when it's still pretty dark, you can actually see it quite easily. And it'll be only, I'm afraid, about 28 degrees or so above the horizon. Sadly, Saturn, in a way, is moving down the ecliptic to where the Sun would be in the winter. And so it will not be rising as high in the sky as it did a few years ago. On the other hand, having been through the point in its orbit where the rings are edge on to us, which was a year or so ago, they are now opening out and are about 15 degrees from the line of sight. That makes it much easier to see the rather prominent dark ring, which is called Cassini's division, that separates two of the rings of Saturn. The angular size is about 17 arc seconds. That'll be gradually getting larger as Saturn becomes nearer to what is called opposition, when it's on the opposite side of the Earth from the Sun, and actually then nearest to us. Mercury, well, that passed in front of the Sun on December, and it's reappeared in the pre-dawn sky towards the southeast. It shines at about magnitude minus 0.4. It's reasonably bright as the month begins, and its brightness, in fact, is slowly increasing up to minus 0.7. It's moving away from the Earth now, and its angular size is thus decreasing down to about 4.8 arc seconds by the end of the month, which means that it's not really possible to see any detail on Mercury, and very few amateur astronomers ever do. Well, Mars is in the ascendant. I'm sure they say that on some of these programs about astrology, but that's not what I'm getting at. It's now rising before midnight, and before dawn, it'll be about 47 degrees due south. So that's not a bad time if you can get yourself up that early to have a look for it. It's increasing its brightness. It'll be minus 0.4 magnitude by the end of the month. And as it gets nearer to us, the angular size is increasing up to 11 arc seconds by month's end. That means it should now be possible to see details on the salmon pink disk. There's a very prominent V-shape Syrtis Major, a major feature on the surface. And the North Polar Cap is actually tilted towards us, and that should be fairly prominent as well. But you do need to have a telescope that's well aligned, collimated is the word, also well cooled down. The markings on Mars are quite subtle, and to see them, you have to try quite hard. Well, Venus, that's now gradually increasing its separation from the Sun and will be 34 degrees away, which sounds quite a long distance. And in fact, I saw it near the equator just a week or so ago, rising that high pretty well, straight above where the Sun had set. Very, very obvious. But sadly, at these northern latitudes, the line of the ecliptic is at quite a shallow angle to the horizon at this time of year. And so even though it's a long way from the Sun, its elevation at sunset is only about 18 degrees. So not quite so obvious to see as you might think. The angular size as it comes nearer to us is increasing. But at the same time, the amount of the surface that we see illuminated is decreasing. The two effects cancel out. And the effect is that the magnitude stays constant at minus 4, which is pretty bright throughout the month. So what about some highlights? Well, we'll start at the beginning and work through the month. On the night 3rd, 4th of January, probably best in the early morning, we have what's called the quadrantids, the quadrantid meteor shower. Now, as I'm sure you all know, the name we give to meteor showers is based upon the constellation in which the radiant, the point from which they appear to diverge, is. And you might say to me, well, I haven't heard of a constellation called the quadrant. Well, of course, it isn't there anymore. It actually was a small constellation named after the quadrant that was used by astronomers such as Tycho Brahe to measure the elevation of a star as it transited, as it went due south. If you measure that elevation and you also measure the time at which that happens, it enables you to plot a chart of the sky, which, of course, Tycho did to great effect. Anyway, it's just between Bootes and the tail, or the handle, I should say, of the plough, the tail of the bear. And I have a map on the night sky page showing you where to look. They can be up to 200 meters per hour, but they're not very bright. There will be a moon in the sky, but it sets about 3:30 in the morning. It's a first quarter moon. And so from about 1 to 2 o'clock, its light should not be too much of a problem. So if it is clear, wrap up well, have a nice woolly hat, nice flask of coffee or something to keep you awake, and go out and have a look, basically towards the north generally. Many of you will not probably have observed a minor planet or asteroid. These lie in what's called the main belt between Mars and Jupiter. The brightest, but not in fact the largest, is called Vesta. And if you look southwest on the 10th of January, should it be clear, you'll actually see the constellation of Aquarius. And very close, just up to the left, just 3 arc minutes away from the fourth magnitude star Tau Aquarii, will lie Vesta, shining at magnitude 8. So a reasonable pair of binoculars should be able to pick it out. I've given a chart on the night sky page to help. On January the 12th, 13th and 14th, you've also got a chance to spot the planet Neptune. Because Venus, which is rising up into the sky, as we've mentioned, basically is just below it on those three nights, particularly on the 13th, when it's only about a degree away, just below to the left of Neptune. Neptune is again magnitude plus 8, so you'll need binoculars to pick it out. But if in fact on the 13th you center Venus in the field of view, you'll easily spot, I hope, Neptune just up and to the right, about a third of the way to the edge of the field of view, something like that. On the 12th and the 14th, it's not quite as close, but again, a little chart will show you how to find it. A nice little skyscape on January the 16th, about an hour before dawn. I've mentioned that Saturn is a pre-dawn object. Well, on that night, we have a nice third quarter moon near Saturn, along with the brightest star in the constellation of Virgo, which is called Spica. In fact, as they rise at about 3 o'clock in the morning, they're in almost a straight line. But by dawn, they've actually sort of moved apart a bit. But a nice little grouping. Saturn, Spica, and a third quarter moon. And finally, on the 26th of January, you've got a chance to spot Venus and a thin crescent moon. So just after sunset, about 4:40 p.m. on the 26th. Venus, as I've said, is about magnitude minus 4, and the moon will really be quite a thin crescent, and that gives you a chance to actually observe what we sometimes call the old moon in the new moon's arms. Earthshine is another way of talking about it. And with binoculars, you should be able to see some of the, quote, dark part of the surface actually illuminated subtly by the light reflected from clouds on the Earth's surface. So that's a nice thing to look at as well. So it's a good month, I think, for observing. I do hope you enjoy it.
Thanks for that, Ian. And now here's John Field to tell us what you can see in the southern night sky this month.
Welcome to the January Jodcast coming from Carter Observatory in Wellington, New Zealand. January finds the planets Venus and Jupiter in our evening sky. Venus is low down in the west, setting about 2 hours after sunset, whilst Jupiter is high in the north and will set around midnight. In early January, Jupiter moves from the constellation of Pisces the Fish and into the constellation of Aries the Ram. Jupiter is now past its best for observing and is slowly fading in brightness and size as it moves away from the Earth. Aries is a faint constellation said to be the ram that rescued two young children from captivity. Another legend has it associated with the story of Jason and the Golden Fleece. This constellation contains a number of double stars, but larger telescopes are needed to easily observe these. In ancient times, the northern hemisphere's spring equinox occurred when the sun was in Aries. This marked the time when the sun crossed from the southern hemisphere sky and into the northern hemisphere sky. This point was used as a starting place of right ascension, the equivalent of longitude on the sky. In sharp contrast to faint Aries, Orion the Hunter, our summer constellation, has a large number of bright stars and sights for binoculars and any size telescope. This bright group of stars dominates our summer evening sky and us southern hemisphere observers hangs upside down. Orion's brightest stars, Rigel, Betelgeuse and Bellatrix, along with the three stars of his belt, form an easily seen pattern in the evening sky. Well placed for viewing is the Orion Nebula, which can be found in the middle of Orion's sword. To the unaided eye, this nebula appears as a fuzzy star to the human eye. If you have binoculars or a small telescope, they will reveal this as a bat-shaped cloud. A 100mm or greater telescope will reveal a number of stars in and around the nebula, which include a tight group of four stars known as the trapezium. It is the ultraviolet radiation from the brightest star in the trapezium that is illuminating the surrounding cloud for a region of about 20 light years. This nebula is estimated to be 1,300 light years away, and stars are still forming in the stellar nursery. If you want to explore the many nebulae and star clusters in and around Orion, a star atlas or a computer-based planetarium program will reveal a host of objects to observe. Marking Orion's left foot is Rigel, the brightest star in Orion, although it is listed as Beta, the second brightest star. It is the sixth brightest star in the night sky, shining at magnitude 0.18. Running from a star nearby to Rigel and across the sky to Echina is the long and rambling constellation of Eridanus the River. In mythology, Eridanus was the river into which Phaeton fell after trying to drive the chariot of his father Helios, the sun god, across the sky. It is also thought that this constellation represents a real river such as the Euphrates or the Nile. It symbolizes the river's unknown source as it disappeared below the southern horizon, as seen from the northern hemisphere, to its termination at Echina, Alpha Eridanus. To ancient Indian astronomers, it represents the Ganges. Originally, Eridanus included the stars of what is now the small constellation of Fornax, Furnace, and it stretched only as far as Beta Eridani, which was then known as Echina, from the Arabic meaning the end of the river. In recent times, Eridanus was extended southwards below the horizon visible to the ancient Greeks, and another star has been assigned the name Echina. To find Eridanus, look to Rigel and Orion, and nearby is Beta Eridani. And along the river, we find a number of interesting sights. Epsilon Eridani is a magnitude 3.7 star, famous by being the most sun-like of all the nearby stars. It is only 10.5 light years away. This yellow dwarf star was one of the first stars to be sent radio signals in case there is life there. Unfortunately, no reply has been received. Beta Eridani Acamar is a striking pair of blue-white stars of magnitudes 3.2 and 4.4. The two stars are separated by just over 8 arc seconds and are easily seen through a telescope. 32 Eridani is a beautiful double star for a small telescope, consisting of a magnitude 5 yellow star and a blue-green magnitude 6.3 companion. Their separation is just under 7 arc seconds, slightly closer than the two stars forming Acama. 40 Eridani is a remarkable triple star system 16 light years away. Small telescopes reveal a magnitude 4.4 yellow star that is similar to our Sun. Nearby is a widely separated magnitude 9.6 white dwarf companion, the most easily seen white dwarf in the sky. Large telescopes will reveal the white dwarf as an 11th magnitude red dwarf companion. Also along the river we find NGC 1535, a small 9th magnitude planetary nebula appearing in a nice field of scattered stars. Eridanus River ends with the star Echina, the 9th brightest star in a nighttime sky. Returning to the northern sky, we find Taurus, along with the Pleiades Matariki to the west of Orion. They will set around midnight. In the summer evening sky, they may twinkle markedly after sunset. This is due to thermal currents in the Earth's atmosphere. After midnight, the Earth's surface and atmosphere has cooled, and the twinkling should decrease, and the view should become steadier. Try counting the number of stars you can see in this cluster with the unaided eye or in binoculars. Long exposure photographs reveal a blue haze surrounding these stars. This haze is coming from a cloud of water ice crystals through which the cluster is moving. To the east of Orion are its two hunting companions, Canis Major the Large and Canis Minor the Small Dog. The brightest star in our night sky, Sirius, marks the collar of Canis Major. For those staying out later, They will see Mars rise after midnight in the constellation of Leo. It will appear as a reddish coloured star and is brighter than any of the other nearby stars. It will slowly brighten as it moves towards opposition, which is in March. This opposition would not be particularly close or bright, but Mars will still be worth a look through a telescope. You might be able to see dark markings on the disk and perhaps a polar cap. Later, Saturn will rise in Virgo and will slowly brighten as it heads towards opposition in April. Saturn's rings are slowly tilting towards us and will lead to better views of the rings later this year. We had a visitor to the inner solar system that may be visible in January. Comet Lovejoy had a close approach to the Sun on December 15, 2011 and will be in the morning sky, and by late December it will be visible throughout the night here in the southern hemisphere. This comet may now have dropped in brightness as it moves away from the Sun and may now only be visible in telescopes. Unfortunately, there are no other bright comets expected to be visible in 2012. Perhaps the astronomical highlight of 2012 will be the transit of Venus on the 6th of June. We hope you have clear skies during these summer nights and take the opportunity to view some of the delights of our southern skies.